She is standing in the doorway, her hands bracing her, like she needs help staying upright. The moon's coming through the window, so she's trapped in her own shadow. As my eyes adjust to the night, I try to see what she sees. The old armchair with a doily over its top. The iron frame of the twin guest bed. The walls, white again. I can still smell the fresh paint. I clear my throat. "We thought it would help," I say, my voice small. She pivots, but only halfway, so that for a second it looks like she's made out of light.
"What if it never happened?"
Britt whispers.
"What if it was just a nightmare?"
She's wearing one of my flannel shirts. That's what she likes to sleep in. And her hands are splayed over her belly. "Britt," I say, taking a step toward her.
"What if no one remembers him?"
I pull her into my arms, feel the hot circle of her breath on my chest. It's like fire. "Baby," I vow, "I'm not going to let anyone forget." I have one suit. Actually, Francis and I have one suit that we share. There's just not much of a need for fancy clothing when you work drywall during the day and run a white power website at night. But the next afternoon I put on the suit. Black pinstripes, the kind of thing I imagine Al Capone would have looked really sharp in. And a white shirt and a tie. And Britt and I drive back to the hospital to meet with Carla Luongo, the lawyer in risk management who has agreed to see us. But when I come out of the bathroom freshly shaved, the tattoo on the back of my head stark and unmistakable, I am surprised to find Britt curled on the bed in my flannel shirt and sweatpants. "Baby," I say, "we have a meeting with the lawyer, remember?" I've told her this a half hour ago. There's no way she forgot. Her eyes roll toward me like they are ball bearings, loose in her head. Her tongue pushes words around her mouth like they're food.
"Don't wanna go back."
She turns away from me, pulling up the covers. And that's when I see the bottle on the nightstand. The sleeping pills that the doctor gave her to help her transition. I take a deep breath and then haul my wife upright. She feels like a sandbag, heavy and immobile. "Shower," I think, but that would require me to get in with her and we don't have time. Instead, I take the glass of water on the bedside table and throw it in her face. She sputters, but it gets her to sit up on her own. I pull off her pajamas and grab the first things I can find in her drawer that look decent, a pair of black pants and a sweater that buttons up the front. As I am dressing her, I have a sudden flash of myself doing this same thing to my baby, and I wind up yanking so hard on Britt's arm that she yelps and I kiss her on the wrist. "Sorry, baby," I murmur, and more gently I pull a comb through her hair and do my best to bunch it together into a ponytail. I stuff her feet into a pair of little black shoes that might actually be bedroom slippers and then haul her into my arms and out to the car. By the time we reach the hospital, she is near catatonic. "Just stay awake," I beg her, anchoring her to my side as we walk in. "For Davis." Maybe that gets through to her, because as we are ushered into the lawyer's office, her eyes open a fraction wider. Carla Luongo is a spick, just like I guessed from her name. She sits down on a chair and offers us a couch. I watch her nearly swallow her tongue when I take off my wool hat. Good. Let her know who she's dealing with right up front. Britt leans against me. "My wife," I explain, "is still not feeling well." The lawyer nods sympathetically.
"Mr. and Mrs. Bauer, let me first just say how sorry I am for your loss."
I don't respond.
"I'm sure you have questions," she says.
I lean forward.
"I don't have questions. I know what happened. That black nurse killed my son. I saw her with my own eyes, beating at his chest. I told her supervisor I didn't want her touching my baby, and what happened? My worst fear came true." "I'm sure you realize that Ms. Jefferson was only doing her job."
"Oh, yeah? Was it also her job to go against what her boss ordered? It was all in Davis's file." The lawyer stands so that she can grab a file on her desk. It's got the little colored confetti of stickers on the side that is some secret code, I imagine. She opens it, and even from here I can see the post-it note. Her nostrils flare, but she doesn't comment. That nurse wasn't supposed to be taking care of my son, I say, and she was left alone with him. Carla Luongo looks at me.
How do you know that, Mr. Bauer?
Because your staff can't keep their voices down. I heard her say she was covering for the other nurse. The day before, she was screaming her head off just because I made a request to take her off my son's case. And what happened? She was pounding on my baby. I watched her, I say, tears springing to my eyes. I wipe them away, feeling foolish, feeling weak. You know what? Fuck this. I'm going to take this hospital to the bank. You killed my son. You're going to pay for it. Honestly, I have no idea how the legal system works. I've done my best to stay away from getting caught by the cops. But I've watched enough TV infomercials to believe that if you can get cash and a class-action lawsuit for having some lung disease brought about by asbestos, you most certainly have a bone to pick if your baby dies when he's supposed to be receiving choice medical care. I grab my suit jacket in one fist and half-drag Britt to the office door. I've just managed to open it when I hear the lawyer's voice behind me.
Mr. Bauer, she asks, why would you sue the hospital?
You're kidding, right? She takes a step forward, gently but firmly closing the door of her office again.
Why would you sue the hospital, she repeats, when everything suggests that Ruth Jefferson was the individual who killed your baby?
About a year into my running the Hartford NADS crew, we had a steady income. I was able to lift guns from Colts by forging inventory and then sell them on the street. Mostly we sold to blacks because they were just going to kill each other with them anyway, and also because they paid three times more for a weapon than the Italians would. Yorkie and I ran the operation, and one night we were on our way home from a deal when a cop car pulled up behind me, its lights flashing. Yorkie nearly shit a brick.
Fuck, man, what do?
We pull over, I told him. It wasn't like we had the stolen gun in the car anymore. As far as the police were concerned, Yorkie and I were headed back from a party at a buddy's apartment. But when the cops asked us to step out of the car, Yorkie was sweating like a coal miner. He looked like he was guilty as sin, which is probably why the police searched the car. I waited because I knew I had nothing to hide. Apparently Yorkie couldn't say the same thing. That gun hadn't been the only deal going down that night. While I was negotiating, Yorkie had bought himself an 8-ball of meth. But because it was in my glove compartment, I went down for it. The thing about doing time is that it was a world I understood, where everyone was separated by race. My sentence for possession was 6 months, and I planned to spend every minute planning my revenge. Yorkie had used before he became part of NADS. It was part of the skater culture. But my squad, they didn't touch drugs, and they sure as hell didn't squirrel them away in my glove compartment. In prison, the black gangs have everyone outnumbered, so sometimes the Latinos and the white gangs will band together. But in jail, you just basically try to keep your head straight and keep out of trouble. I knew that if there was anyone in the white power movement who happened to be in doing time, they would find me sooner or later. But I was hoping that the niggers wouldn't find me first. I took to keeping my nose buried in a Bible. I needed God in my life because I had a public defender, and when you have a public defender, you'd better hope that God's on your side, too. But I wasn't reading the parts of scripture I'd read before when I was learning the doctrines of Christian identity theology. Instead, I found myself dog-earing the pages about suffering and salvation and hope. I fasted because I read something about it in the Bible. And during my fast, God told me to surround myself with other people like me. So the next day I showed up at the jail Bible study group. I was the only guy there who wasn't black. At first we just stared at each other. Then the dude running the meeting jerked his chin at a kid who couldn't have been much older than me, and he made a space next to himself. We all held hands, and when I held his, it was soft, like my father's hands used to be. I have no idea why that popped into my head, but that's what I was thinking when they started to say the Lord's Prayer. And then suddenly I was saying it along with them. I went to Bible study every day. When we finished reading scripture, we'd say Amen And then Big Ike, who ran the group, would ask, "Who's got court tomorrow?" Usually someone would say they had a preliminary hearing or that the arresting officer was testifying or something like that. And Big Ike would say, "All right then, let's pray that the officer don't throw you under no bus." And he'd find a passage in the Bible about redemption. Twinkie was the black kid who was my age. We talked a lot about girls and how we missed hooking up with them. But believe it or not, we talked more about the food we craved on the outside. Me, I would have committed a felony for Taco Bell. Twinkie only wanted Chef Boyardee. Somehow it didn't matter so much what color his skin was. Had I met him on the streets of Hartford, I would have kicked his ass. But in jail, it was different. We'd team up when we played spades, cheating with hand signals and eye rolls that we made up in private, because no one expected the white power guy and the black kid to be working together. One day I was sitting in the common room with a bunch of white guys when a gang shooting came in on the midday news. The anchor on the TV was talking about how the bullets sprayed, how many people had been hit by accident. "That's why if we ever go at it with the gangs," I said, "we win. They don't go target shooting like us. They don't know how to hold weapons. Look at that death grip. Typical nigger bullshit." Twink wasn't sitting with us, but I could see him across the room. His eyes sort of skated over me, and then back to whatever he was doing. Later that day, we were playing cards for cigarettes, and I gave him a sign to come back in diamonds, because I was cutting diamond spades. Instead, he threw clubs, and we lost. As we were walking out of the common room, I turned on him. "What the hell, dude? I gave you a sign." He looked right at me. "Guess it's just typical nigga bullshit," he said. I thought, shit, I hurt his feelings. Then, "So what?" It's not like I stopped using that word. But I'll admit, sometimes when I said it, it stuck in my throat like a fishbone before I could cough it free. Francis finds me just as I put my boot through the front window of our duplex, pushing out the old casing so that it explodes onto the porch in a rain of splinters and glass. He folds his arms, raises a brow. "Sill's rotted out," I explain, "and I didn't have a pry bar." With a gaping hole in the wall, the cold air rushes into the house. It feels good, because I'm on fire. "So this has nothing to do with your meeting," Francis says, in a way that suggests it has everything to do with the last half hour I've spent at the local police department. It was my next stop after the hospital. I dropped off Britt, who crawled back into bed, and drove straight there. My meeting, really, was not even a meeting, just me sitting across from a fat cop named McDougal who filed my complaint against Ruth Jefferson. "He said he'd do a little research," I mutter, "which means I'll never hear from him again." "What did you tell him?" That bitch killed my baby." McDougal didn't know anything about my son, or what had happened at the hospital, so I had to tell the whole story over again. McDougal asked me what I wanted from him, as if it wasn't evident. "I want to bury my son," I told him, "and I want her to pay for what she did." The cop asked if maybe I was just overcome with grief, if I had misinterpreted what I saw. "She wasn't just doing CPR," I told McDougal. "She was hurting my baby. Even one of the other doctors told her to lighten up." I said she had it in for me. Immediately the cop glanced at my tattoos. "No kidding," he said. "It's a fucking hate crime, that's what it is," I tell Francis now. "But God forbid anyone stand up for the Anglos, even though we're a minority now." My father-in-law falls into place beside me, ripping a piece of flashing out of the window cavity with his bare hands. "You're preaching to the choir, Turk," he says. Francis may not have talked publicly about white power in years, but I happen to know that in a locked storage facility 3 miles away from here, he is stockpiling weapons for the racial holy war. "I hope you're planning on sealing this up," he says, and I pretend he isn't talking about the window. Just then my cell phone rings. I fish it out of my pocket and don't recognize the number on the screen. "Hello? Mr. Bauer, this is Sergeant McDougal. I spoke with you earlier today." I curl my hand around the phone and turn away, forging a wall of privacy with my back.
I wanted to let you know that I had a chance to talk to risk management at the hospital, as well as to the medical examiner. Carla Luongo corroborated your story. The ME was able to tell me that your son died due to hypoglycemic seizure, which led to respiratory and then cardiac arrest. So what does that mean? Well, he says, the death certificate's been released to the hospital. You can bury your son. I close my eyes, and for a moment I can't even find a response. Okay, I manage. There's one more thing, Mr. Bauer, McDougal adds. The medical examiner confirmed that there was bruising on your son's ribcage. My whole future hinges on the breath between that sentence and his next. There's evidence that Ruth Jefferson may have been at fault in the death of your son, and that it could have been a racially motivated incident, McDougal says. I'm putting in a call to the district attorney's office. Thank you, I say gruffly, and I hang up the phone. Then my knees give out, and I land heavily in front of the damaged sill. I can feel Francis's hand on my shoulder. Even though there's no barrier between me and the outside, I struggle to breathe. I'm sorry, Turk, Francis says, misinterpreting my response. Don't be. I pull myself up and run to the dark bedroom where Britt is hibernating beneath a mound of covers. I throw open the curtains and let the sun flood the room. I watch her roll over, wincing, squinting, and I take her hand. I can't give her our baby, but I can give her the next best thing. Justice. While I had been plotting my revenge against Yorkie during my 6 months in jail, he had been busy too. He'd allied himself with a group of bikers called the Pagans. They were hulking thugs who were, I assumed, somehow involved with meth, like him. And they were more than delighted to have his back if it meant they could take down the leader of the Hartford Nads. Street cred like that went a long way. I spent my first day out of jail trying to round up the old members of my crew, but they all knew what was about to go down, and they all had an excuse. I gave up everything for you, I said when I had exhausted even the freshest cut in the squad. And this is how you repay me? But the last thing I was going to do was let anyone think going to jail had dulled my edges. So that night I went to the pizza place that used to be the unofficial headquarters of my crew, and waited until I heard the growl of a dozen bikes pull up. I threw down my jacket, cracked my knuckles, and walked out to the alley behind the restaurant. Yorkie, the son of a bitch, was hiding behind a wall of muscle. Seriously, the smallest Pagan was about 6'5 and 300 pounds. I may have been smaller, but I was fast, and none of those guys had grown up ducking from my grandfather's fists. I wish I could tell you what happened that night, but all I have to go on is what I've heard from others. How I ran like a freaking berserker at the biggest guy, and revved up my arm so that my punch caught him square in the mouth and knocked out his entire front row of teeth. How I lifted one dude off his feet and sent him like a cannonball into the others. How I kicked a biker so hard in his kidney he allegedly pissed red for a month. How blood ran in the alley like rain on pavement. All I know is I had nothing left to lose but my reputation, and that's enough ammunition to power a war. I don't remember any of it, except waking up the next morning in the pizza joint, with a bag of ice on my broken hand and one eye swollen shut. I don't remember any of it, but word spread. I don't remember any of it, but once again, I was the stuff of legend. On the day I bury my son, the sun is shining. The wind's coming from the west and it has teeth. I stand in front of the tiny hole in the ground. I don't know who organized this whole funeral. Someone had to call to get a plot, to let people know there would be a service. I assume it was Francis, who now stands at the front of the casket, reading a verse from Scripture. For this child I prayed, and the Lord hath given me my petition which I asked of him, Francis recites. Therefore also I have lent him to the Lord. As long as he liveth, he shall be lent to the Lord, and he worshipped the Lord there. There are guys from the drywall crew here and some of Britt's friends in the movement, but there are also people I don't know who have come to pay their respects to Francis. One of them is Tom Metzger,
the man who founded the White Aryan Resistance. He's 78 now, a loner like Francis. When Britt starts sobbing during the reading of the psalm, I reach out to her, but she pulls away. Instead, she turns to Metzger, who she called Uncle Tommy when she was growing up. He puts an arm around her, and I try not to feel the absence of her as a slap. I've heard plenty of platitudes today. He's in a better place. He's a fallen soldier. Time heals all wounds. What no one told me about grief is how lonely it is. No matter who else is mourning, you're in your own little cell. Even when people try to comfort you, you're aware that now there is a barrier between you and them, made of the horrible thing that happened, that keeps you isolated. I had thought that at the very least Britt and I would hurt together, but she can barely stand to look at me. I wonder if it's for the same reason I have avoided her, because I look at her eyes and I see them in Davis's face, because I notice the dimple in her chin and think that my son had it too. She, who used to be everything I ever wanted, is a constant memory now of everything I've lost. I focus my attention on the casket being lowered into the ground. I keep my eyes extra wide because if I do that, the tears won't spill over and I won't look like a pussy. I start making a list in my head of all the things I will never get to do with my son. See him smile for the first time. Celebrate his first Christmas. Get him a BB gun. Give him advice to ask a girl out. Milestones. But the road of parenthood for me has been wiped clean of landmarks. Suddenly Francis is standing in front of me with a shovel. I swallow hard, take it, and become the first person to start to bury my child. After pushing a scoop of dirt into the rip in the ground, I jam the shovel into the earth again. Tom Metzger helps Britt lift it, her hands shaking, and do her part. I know I'm supposed to stand vigil while everyone else here helps to put Davis underground, but I'm too busy fighting the urge to dive into that tiny pit, to shovel the dirt out with my bare hands, to lift the casket, to pry it open, to save my baby. I'm holding myself in check so hard that my body is vibrating with the effort. And then something happens that diffuses all that tension, that twists the escape valve so that the steam inside me disappears. Britt's hand slips into mine. Her eyes are still vacant with drugs and pain. Her body is angled away from me, but she definitely reached out. She definitely needed me. For the first time in a week, I start to think that maybe we will survive. When Francis Mitchum summons you, you go. In the aftermath of my rout of the pagans, I received a handwritten note from Francis telling me that he'd heard the rumors and wanted to see if they were true. He invited me to meet him the following Saturday in New Haven and included an address. I was a little surprised to drive there and find it smack in the middle of a subdivision, but I assumed it was a gathering of his squad when I saw the cars parked out front. When I rang the doorbell, no one answered, but I could hear activity in the backyard. So I edged around the side of the house and let myself in through the unlocked fence. Almost immediately I was run down by a swarm of kids. They were probably about 5 years old, not that I had too much experience with humans of that size. They were racing toward a woman who was holding a baseball bat, trying to direct the unruly group into some form of line. "It's my birthday," one little boy said, "so I get to go first." He grabbed for the bat and began to swing it at a piñata, a papier-mâché nigger hanging from a noose. Well, at least I knew I was in the right place. I turned in the other direction and came face to face with a girl who was holding stars in her hands. She had long, curly hair, and her eyes were the palest shade of blue I'd ever seen. I'd been hit 100 times before, but never like that. I couldn't remember the word hello. "Well," she said, "you're a little old for games, but you can have a turn if you want." I just stared at her, confused, until I realized that she was referring to the hook-nosed profile poster taped up on the side of the house. I wanted to play, yes, but "Pin the Star on the Jew" wasn't what I had in mind. "I'm looking for Francis Mitchum," I said. "He asked me to meet him here?" She looked at me, her eyes narrowing. "You must be Turk,"
she said. He's expecting you. She turned on her heel and walked into the house with the easy grace of someone who is used to having people follow in her wake. We passed a few women in the kitchen who were bouncing from fridge to cabinets and back like popcorn kernels on a hot griddle, exploding one at a time with commands, "Get the plates! Don't forget the ice cream!" There were more kids inside, but they were older. Preteen, I was guessing, because they reminded me of me not that long ago, held in thrall by the man who stood in front of them. Francis Mitchum was shorter than I remembered, but then I'd last seen him on a podium. His silver hair was lush and swept back from his face, and he was lecturing on Christian identity theology. "The snake," he explained, "has sex with Eve." The kids looked around at each other when he said the word sex, as if hearing it spoken out loud so casually was their welcome into the sanctum of adulthood. "Why else would God say she couldn't eat an apple? They're in a garden, for Pete's sake. The apple is a symbol, and the downfall of man is getting laid. The devil comes to Eve in the form of a snake, and she's tricked into messing around, and she gets pregnant. But then she goes back to Adam and tricks him into having sex. She has Cain, who's born with the mark of the devil on him, a 666, a Star of David. That's right, Cain is the first Jew. But she also gives birth to Abel, who's Adam's kid. And Cain kills Abel because he's jealous, and he's the seed of Satan." "You believe in this bullshit?" asked the beautiful girl beside me. Her voice was as even as a seam. It felt like a trick. Some white power folks were Christian identity followers, and some weren't. Rain was. Francis was. I was. We believed that we were the real house of Israel, God's chosen ones. The Jews were imposters and would be wiped out during the race war. I grinned. When I was about their age, I was starving and I stole a hot dog at a gas station. I didn't care so much about stealing, but for 2 weeks I was convinced God was going to smite me for eating pork. When she met my gaze, it felt like the space between the moment you turned on a stove's pilot light and the moment it was blue and burning. It felt like the possibility of an explosion. "Daddy," she announced. "Your guest is here." "Daddy?" Francis Mitchum glanced at me, turning his attention away from the clod of preteens he'd been talking to, who were staring at me too. He stepped over the tangle of adolescent limbs and clapped me on the shoulder. "Turk Bauer, it's good of you to come." "It's an honor to be asked," I replied. "I see you've already met Brittany," Francis said. "Brittany." "Not officially." I held out my hand. "Hi." "Hi," Britt repeated, laughing. She held on a moment too long, but not enough for anyone to notice. Except Mitchum, who, I assumed, did not miss much. "Walk with me a bit," he said, and I fell into step beside him as we returned to the backyard. We chatted about the weather, late start to spring this year, and the drive from Hartford to New Haven, too much construction on I-91S. When we reached a corner of the yard near an apple tree, Mitchum sat down on a lawn chair and gestured for me to do the same. From here we had a bird's-eye view of the piñata game. The birthday boy was up to bat again, but so far no candy had been spilled. "That's my godson," Mitchum said. I was wondering why I got invited to a kid's party. "I like talking to the next generation," he admitted. "Makes me still feel relevant." "Oh, I don't know about that, sir. I'd say you're still pretty relevant." "Now you," Mitchum said. "You've made quite a name for yourself lately." I just nodded. I wasn't sure why Francis Mitchum had wanted to meet me. "I hear your brother was killed by a nigger," he said, "and your father's a flamer." My head swung up, cheeks hot. "He's not my father anymore." "Take it easy, boy. None of us can pick our parents. It's what we choose to make of them that's important." He looked at me. "When was the last time you saw him?"
"When I was beating him unconscious."
Again, I felt like I was being given a quiz, and I must have answered correctly because Mitchum kept talking. "You've started your own crew, and by many accounts, you're the best recruiter on the East Coast.
You took the rap for your second in command and then taught him a lesson as soon as he got out of jail.
Just doing what needed to be done.
Well, Mitchum answered, there aren't too many like you nowadays. I thought honor was a commodity that was going extinct. Just then, one of the other little boys snapped the neck off the piñata and the candy cascaded onto the grass. The kids fell on it, grabbing up sweets in their fists. The birthday boy's mother came out of the kitchen carrying a platter of cupcakes.
Happy birthday to you, she started to sing, and the children crowded around the picnic table.
Brittany stepped out onto the porch. Her fingers were blue with icing. Back when I was running a squad, Mitchum said, no one in the movement would have been caught dead being a junkie. Now, for the love of God, Aryan boys are teaming up with redskins on reservations to make meth somewhere the feds can't intervene.
Happy birthday to you.
They're not teaming up, I told Mitchum. They're banding together against common enemies. The Mexicans and the blacks, I'm not defending what they're doing, but I understand why they might be unlikely allies.
Happy birthday, dear Jackson.
Mitchum narrowed his gaze. Unlikely allies, he repeated. For example, an old guy with experience and a young guy with the biggest balls I've ever seen. A man who knows the former generation of Anglos and one who could lead the next. A fellow who grew up on the streets and one who grew up with technology. Why, that could be quite a pairing.
Happy birthday to you.
Across the yard, Britt caught my eye and blushed.
I'm listening, I said.
After the funeral, everyone comes back to the house. There are casseroles and pies and platters, none of which I eat. People keep telling me they're sorry for our loss, as if they had something to do with it. Francis and Tom sit outside on the porch, which still has some shards of glass on it from my window project, and drink the bottle of whiskey Tom's brought. Britt sits on a couch like the middle of a flower, surrounded by the petals of her friends. When someone she doesn't know well comes too near, they close around her. Eventually they leave, saying things like, call me if you need me, and every day it'll get a little easier. In other words, lies. I am just walking the last guest out when a car pulls up. The door opens and McDougal, the cop who took my complaint, gets out. He walks up the steps to where I am standing, his hands in his pockets. I don't have any information for you yet, he says bluntly. I came to pay my respects. I feel Britt come up behind me like a shadow. Babe, this is the officer who's going to help us.
When?
She asks. Well, ma'am, investigations into these things take time.
These things,
Britt repeats. These things! She shoves past me so that she is toe-to-toe with the cop. My son is not a thing! Was, she corrects, her voice snagging. Was not a thing. Then she turns on her heel and disappears into the belly of the house. I look at the cop. It's been a tough day. I understand. As soon as the prosecutor contacts me, I'll be in... He doesn't finish his sentence, however, before the sound of a crash fills all the space behind me. I have to go, I tell him, but I'm already closing the door in his face. There's another crash before I reach the kitchen. As soon as I step inside, a casserole dish flies by my face, striking the wall behind me. Britt! I cry out, moving toward her, and she wings a glass at my head. It glances off my brow, and for a moment I see stars.
Is this supposed to make me feel better?
Britt screams.
I fucking hate mac and cheese!
Baby, I grasp her by the shoulders. They were trying to be nice.
I don't want them to be nice,
she says, tears streaming down her face now.
I don't want their pity. I don't want anything, except that bitch who killed my baby.
I fold my arms around her, even though she stays stiff in them. This isn't over yet. She shoves at me so hard and so unexpectedly that I stumble backward.
It should be,
she says, with
with so much venom in her words that I am paralyzed.
It would be, if you were a real man!
A muscle ticks in my jaw and I ball my hands into fists, but I don't react. Francis, who's entered the room at some point, comes up behind Britt and slips an arm around her waist.
Come on now, Ladybug. Let's get you upstairs. He leads her out of the kitchen. I know what she's saying. That a warrior isn't much of a warrior when he's fighting behind a computer. True, going underground with our movement was Francis's idea, and it's been a brilliant and insidious plan, but Britt's right. There's a big difference between the instant gratification that comes from landing a punch and the delayed pride that comes from spreading fear through the internet. I grab the car keys off the kitchen counter and a moment later I'm cruising downtown near the railroad tracks. I think for a heartbeat about finding that black nurse's address. I have the technological expertise to do it in less than 2 minutes, which is about as long as it would take the cops to point a finger at me if anything happened to her or her property. Instead, I park under a railroad overpass and get out of the car. My heart's pounding, my adrenaline is high. It's been so long since I've been wilding that I've forgotten the high of it, unlike anything that alcohol or sports or even falling in love can produce. The first person that gets in my way is unconscious. Homeless, he's drunk or drugged or asleep on a cardboard pallet under a mountain of plastic bags. He's not even black. He's just easy. I grab him by the throat and he startles from one nightmare into another.
What are you looking at?
I scream into his face, even though I have him pinned by the neck so that he couldn't be looking at anything but me.
What the fuck is your problem?
Then I headbutt him in the mouth so that I knock his teeth loose. I throw him back on the pavement, hearing a satisfying crack as his skull meets the ground. With every blow, I can breathe a little easier. It has been years since I did this. But it feels like yesterday. My fists have a muscle memory. I pound this stranger into someone who will never be recognized, since it's the only way to remember who I am.
Ruth. When you are a nurse, you know better than most anyone else that life goes on. There are good days and there are bad days. There are patients who stay with you and those you can't wait to forget. But there is always another mother in labor or delivering who drives you forward. There is always a new crop of tiny humans who haven't even written the first sentence in the story of their lives. The process of birth is such an assembly line, in fact, that it always surprises me when I am forced to stop and look twice, like when a baby I helped delivered seemingly yesterday is suddenly my patient about to have her own child, or when the phone rings and the hospital lawyer asks if I could just come in to talk. I'm not sure that I have ever conversed with Carla Luongo. In fact, I'm not sure that I knew the hospital lawyer, pardon me, risk management liaison, was named Carla Luongo. But then I've never been in trouble before. I've never been a risk that needs to be managed. It's been 2 weeks since Davis Bauer's death. 14 days of me going into work and doing my business, hanging IVs and telling women to push and teaching them how to get a newborn to latch on. But more important, it's been 14 nights when I've awakened with a start, reliving not that infant's death, but the moments before, playing them in slow motion and reversing them and erasing the edges of the narrative in my head so that I start to believe what I've told myself. What I've told others. What I tell Carla Luongo on the phone when she calls. I'd be happy to meet with you, I say. When what I really mean is, am I in trouble? Terrific, she replies. How does 10 o'clock sound? Today my shift begins at 11, so I tell her that's fine. I scribble down the floor number where her office is just as Edison walks into the kitchen. He crosses, opens the fridge, and takes the orange juice from inside. He looks like he's about to drink right from the bottle, but I raise one eyebrow, and he thinks otherwise. Ruth, Carla Luongo says into my ear, are you still there? Yes, sorry. See you soon, then. Looking forward to it, I say, brightly, and hang up. Edison sits down and piles a heap of cereal into a bowl. Were you talking to someone white? What kind of question is that? He shrugs and pours the milk into the bowl, curling his answer around the spoon he tucks into his mouth. Your voice changes. Carla Luongo has a run in her hose. I should be thinking of many other things, including why this interview is even necessary, but I find myself focusing on the tear in her pantyhose and thinking that if she were anyone else, anyone I considered a friend, I would quietly tell her to spare her any embarrassment. The thing is, even though Carla keeps telling me she's on my side, there are sides, and that this is a formality, I am finding it hard to believe her. I have spent the past 20 minutes recounting in explicit detail how I wound up in the nursery alone with the Bauer baby. So you were told not to touch the infant, the lawyer repeats. Yes, I say, for the 20th time. And you didn't touch him until... How did you phrase it? She clicks the cap of her pen. Until I was directed to by Marie, the charge nurse. And what did she say? She asked me to start compressions. I sigh. Look, you've written all this down. I can't tell you anything else I haven't already told you, and my shift's about to start. So, are we about done here? The lawyer leans forward, her elbows balanced on her knees. Did you have any interactions with the parents? Briefly, before I was removed from the baby's care. Were you angry? I beg your pardon? Were you angry? I mean, you were left to care for this infant by yourself when you'd already been given the directive to leave him alone. We were short-handed. I knew it wouldn't be long until Corinne or Marie came back to relieve me, I reply, and then realize I haven't answered her question. I wasn't angry. Yet Dr. Atkins says you made an offhand comment about sterilizing the baby, the lawyer says. My jaw drops. You spoke to the pediatrician? It's my job to speak to everyone, she says. I look up at her. The parents obviously think I'm contaminated, I say. It was a stupid joke. One that would have meant nothing at all if everything else hadn't happened. If. Were you keeping an eye on the baby? Were you even looking at him? I hesitate. And even in that breath, I can feel that this is the linchpin. The moment I will come back to and rub over in my mind until it is so smooth I can't remember every knot and groove and detail. I can't tell the lawyer that I disobeyed Marie's orders because it could cost me my job. But I can't tell her that I tried to resuscitate the infant either because then those orders suddenly seem legitimate. Since I touched the baby and he died. The baby was fine, I say carefully. And then I heard him gasp. What did you do? I look at her. I followed orders. I was told not to do anything, I tell Carla Luongo. So I didn't. I hesitate. You know, another nurse in my situation might have looked at that note in the infant's file and found it biased. She knows what I'm implying. I could sue the hospital for discrimination. Or at least I want her to think I can. When in reality, doing so would cost me money I don't have for a lawyer, as well as my friendships and my job. Naturally, Carla says smoothly, that's not the kind of team player we'd want on staff. In other words, keep threatening to sue, and your career here is history. She jots something down in her little black leather notebook and then stands up. Well, she says, thanks for taking the time. No problem. You know where to find me. Oh, yes, she says. And the whole way back to the birthing pavilion, I try to shake the sense that those two simple words could be a threat. When I get back to my floor, however, I don't have time to wallow in self-doubt. Marie sees me step out of the elevator and grabs my arm with relief. Ruth, she says, meet Virginia. Virginia, this is Ruth, one of our most experienced L&D nurses. I look at the woman standing in front of me, wide-eyed as she watches a gurney being wheeled down the hallway for what must be a stat C-section. That's all I need to understand what's going on here. Virginia, I say smoothly. Marie's got a lot on her plate right now, so why don't you shadow me? Marie tosses me a silent thank you and runs after the gurney. So, I say to Virginia, non-traditional student? Unlike most of the baby-faced nursing candidates we get parading through here, Virginia is in her 30s. Late start, she explains, or early, depending on how you look at it. I had my kids young and wanted them out of the house before I started my official career. You probably think I'm crazy to be going back to school this old. Better late than never, I say. Besides, being a mom ought to count as on-the-job training for L&D, don't you think? I intercept the nurse who's coming off duty and figure out which rooms I'm taking over. A couplet with a GDM G1, now P1, at 40 weeks and 4 days, who had a vaginal delivery at 5 a.m. Baby is on Q3-hour blood sugars for 24 hours. A G2 P1 at 38 weeks and 2 days in active labor. It's like alphabet soup, Virginia says. It's just shorthand, I laugh. You get used to it. But I'll translate for you. We're taking over 2 rooms. One is a mom with gestational diabetes who delivered this morning and whose baby needs sugars every 3 hours. One is a woman in labor who already has 1 kid, I say, so at least she's done this before. Just follow my lead. With that, I push into her room. Hello, Miss Bronstein, I say to the patient who is holding onto her partner's hand in a death grip. I hear you're a repeat customer. My name is Ruth, and this is Virginia. Virginia, it looks like Mr. Bronstein here could use a chair. Can you pull one closer? I keep up a constant calm chatter as I examine her strip and feel her belly. Everything looks good. Doesn't feel good, the woman grits out. We can take care of that, I say smoothly. Mrs. Bronstein turns to Virginia. I want a water birth. That's on my plan. Virginia nods tentatively. Okay. Once we monitor you for 20 minutes or so, we'll see how the baby's doing, and if it's possible, we'll definitely get you into the tub, I say. The other thing is that we don't want a circumcision if it's a boy, Mrs. Bronstein says. We're having a bris. Not a problem, I tell her. I'll make a note in the file. I'm pretty sure I'm at about 6 centimeters, she says. When I had Eli, I threw up just about then, and I'm starting to feel queasy now. I reach for the emesis basin and pass it to Virginia. Let's see if we can examine you before that happens, I suggest, and I slip on a pair of latex gloves, pulling up the sheet at the end of the bed. Mrs. Bronstein turns to Virginia. Are you sure that's a good idea? She turns to me. Yes? I lower the sheet. Mrs. Bronstein, I say, Virginia is a nursing student. I've been in this business for 20 years. If you want, I'm sure she'd be delighted to add to her education by seeing how many centimeters you're dilated. But if you're in any sort of discomfort and just want to get that part of this over with, I'd be happy to accommodate you. Oh! The patient turns bright red. I just assumed that she is in charge. Because even though Virginia is 10 years younger than me, she is white. I exhale the same way I tell my eminent mothers to exhale. And, like them, with that breath, I let the frustration go. I put a gentle hand on Mrs. Bronstein's knee and offer her a professional smile. Let's just get this baby out, I suggest. My mama still works for Mina Hollowell in her Upper West Side brownstone. Ever since Mr. Sam passed, it's Ms. Mina that my mom is supposed to be helping. Her daughter Christina lives nearby but has her own life. Her son Louis lives in London with his husband, a director in the West End. Apparently, I'm the only person who finds it ironic that Mama is 3 years older than the woman she's supposed to be assisting. Every time I've talked to my mama about retiring, though, she shrugs me off and says the Hollowells need her. I'd venture that my mama needs the Hollowells just as much, if only to feel like she still has a purpose. My mother only has off on Sundays, and since I usually am asleep that day after a long Saturday night shift, when I visit her, it has to be at the brownstone instead. I don't visit very often, though. I tell myself it's because I have work, or Edison, or 1,000 other reasons that take precedence. But in reality, it's because a little piece of me dies every time I walk inside and see my mama in that shapeless blue uniform with a white apron wrapped around her hips. You'd think after all this time, Ms. Mina would just tell Mama to dress the way she likes, but no. Maybe this is the reason why, when I do visit, I make a point of using the front entrance, with the doorman, instead of the servant's elevator in the back of the building. There's just some perverse part of me that likes knowing I will be announced like any other guest. That the name of the maid's daughter will be written down in a log. Today, when my mother lets me inside, she gives me a big hug. Ruth! If this isn't the best surprise, I just knew today was going to be a good one. Really? I say. Why? Well, I put on my heavy coat because the weather's turning, and wouldn't you know I found a $20 bill in the pocket left behind from last fall when I wore it. And I said to myself, Lou, this is either a good omen or else it's the start of Alzheimer's. She grins. I chose the former. I love the way her wrinkles have weathered her smile. I love seeing how age will look on my face one day. Is my grandbaby here too? She asks, looking behind me in the hall. Did you bring him for another one of those college visits? No, Mama, he's in classes now. You're gonna have to make do with just me. Just you, she teases. As if that was never enough. She closes the door behind her as I unbutton my coat. She holds out her hand for it, but I reach into the closet instead for a hanger. The last thing I'm going to do is make my mama wait on me, too. I put my coat next to hers, and just for old time's sake, run my hand down the soft underbelly of Mama's lucky scarf before closing the closet door. Where's Miss Mina? I ask. Shopping downtown with Christina and the baby, she says. I don't want to interrupt you if you're busy. For you, baby, I always have time. Come into the dining room. I'm just doing a little cleaning. She starts down the hallway and I follow, carefully noticing the way she's favoring her right knee because of the bursitis in her left. On the dining room table, a white sheet is spread, and the strings of crystal that form the massive chandelier overhead are laying on it like trails of tears. A pungent bowl of ammonia solution sits in the center. My mother sits down and resumes her task of dipping each strand, then letting it air dry. How did you get those down? I ask, eyeing the chandelier. Carefully, my mama replies. I think about her balancing on the table or a chair. It's too dangerous for you to do that kind of stuff anymore. She waves me away. I've been doing this for 50 years, my mama says. I could clean crystal in a coma. We'll keep climbing up to get them down from the chandelier and you might get your wish, I frown. Did you go to the orthopedist whose name I gave you? Ruth, stop babying me. She starts to fill the space between us by asking about Edison's grades. She says that Adisa is worried about her 16-year-old dropping out of high school, something she failed to mention to me at the nail salon. As we talk, I help lift strands of crystal and dip them into the ammonia solution, feeling the liquid burn my skin and pride, even more bitter, burn the back of my throat. When my sister and I were little, Mama used to bring us here on Saturdays to work. She framed this as a big deal, a privilege. Not all kids are well-behaved enough to shadow a parent at a job. If you're good, you get to push the button on the dumbwaiter that brings the dishes up from the dining room to the kitchen. But what started as a treat soured quickly for me. True, sometimes we got to play with Christina and her Barbies, but when she had a friend over, Rachel and I were evicted to the kitchen or the laundry room, where Mama showed us how to iron cuffs and collars. At 10, I finally rebelled. Maybe you're okay with this, but I don't want to be Ms. Mina's slave, I told my mother, loud enough to maybe be overheard, and she slapped me. You do not use that word to describe an honest, paying job, my mama corrected. The same job that put that sweater on your back and those shoes on your feet. What I didn't realize at the time was that our apprenticeship had a higher purpose. We were learning the whole time how to make hospital corners on a bed, how to get stains out of the grout, how to make a roux. My mama had been teaching us to be self-sufficient so that we'd never be in the position Ms. Mina was in, unable to do things for ourselves. We finish cleaning the crystal drops, and I stand on a chair while my mama hands them to me one by one to hang from the chandelier again. They are blinding in their beauty. So, Mama says when we are nearly finished, are you going to tell me what's wrong, or do I have to pry it loose? Nothing's wrong, I was just missing you, that's all. It's true. I came to Manhattan because I wanted to see her. I wanted to go somewhere where I knew I'd be valued. What happened at work, Ruth? When I was a child, my mother's intuition was so uncanny it took me many years to realize she wasn't psychic. She didn't know the future. She just knew me. Usually you can't stop talking about a set of triplets or a father-in-law who punched out a new daddy in the waiting room. Today you haven't mentioned the hospital at all. I step down from the chair and fold my arms. The best lies are the ones that are wrapped around a core of truth. So although I conspicuously leave out any mention of Turk Bauer or the dead baby or Carla Luongo, I tell Mama about the nursing student and the patient who so easily assumed that she was the one in charge instead of me. The words spill like a waterfall, with more force behind them than I expect. By the time I am finished, we are both sitting in the kitchen, and my mother has set a cup of tea down in front of me. Mama purses her lips, as if she's weighing the evidence. Maybe you just imagined it. I wonder if this is why I'm the way I am. The reason I tend to make excuses for everyone but myself, and try so hard to fit in seamlessly. My mother modeled that behavior for years. But what if she's right? Could I be overreacting? I replay the interaction in my head, but it's not the same as the incident with Turk Bauer. Mrs. Bronstein didn't even mention the color of my skin. What if my mama's right, and I'm the one who's being overly sensitive? What if I'm making the assumption that the patient's comments were made because Virginia's white and I'm not? Doesn't that make me the one who can't see past race? Clear as a bell, I hear Adisa's voice in my head. That's just what they want, for you to doubt yourself. As long as they can make you think you're not worthy, they still got you in chains. I'm sure the lady didn't mean anything by it, Mama pronounces, but it didn't make me feel any less small. I don't say it out loud, but I think it, and it sends a shiver down my spine. This isn't me. I don't accuse. I don't believe the majority of white people judge me because I'm black or assume they are superior to me. I don't prowl the world looking for an excuse to pick a fight. I leave that to Adisa. Me? I do my best to fly under the radar. Sure, I know that racism exists and that people like Turk Bauer are waving that banner, but I don't judge all white folks by the historical actions of a few. Or rather, I never have before. It's as if the little post-it note on the patient file of Davis Bauer has nicked a vital artery, and I can't figure out how to stop the bleeding. Suddenly we hear a jangle of keys and bluster as Ms. Mina and her daughter and grandson return to the brownstone. Mama hurries into the foyer to take their coats and their shopping bags, and I trail after her. Christina's eyes widen when she sees me, and she throws her arms around me while Mama peels the snowsuit off her 4-year-old son, Felix. Ruth, she cries. This is fate. Mom, wasn't I just talking to you about Ruth's son? Ms. Mina looks up at me. She was indeed, Ruth. Dear, aren't you just beautiful? Not a single wrinkle on that skin. I swear, you don't age. Again, I hear Adisa in my head. Black don't crack. Very forcefully, I tamp down on that voice and gently fold tiny Ms. Mina into an embrace. Neither do you, Ms. Mina, I say. Oh, go on with those lies. She pretends to wave away my words and then smiles slyly. No, seriously, go on with them. I love hearing everyone. I try to signal to my mama. I should probably be going. Don't cut your visit short on our account, Ms. Mina says, taking Felix from Mama's arms. You stay as long as you want. She turns to Mama. Lou, we'll take our tea in the gold room. Christina grabs my hand. Come with me, she says, and she drags me up the stairs to the bedroom where we used to play. It's a shrine of sorts, with the same furniture she had as a child, but now there is a crib and a litter of toys on the floor. I step on something that nearly hobbles me, and Christina rolls her eyes. Oh, God, Felix's Playmobil men. Crazy, right? To spend hundreds of dollars on something plastic? But you know Felix, he loves his pirates. I crouch down, examine the intricate ship as Christina rummages through the closet. There is a captain in a red coat and a feathered black hat, and several pirates tangled in the plastic web of rigging. On the deck there is a character with plastic skin that's an orange-brown, with a little silver collar around his neck. Good Lord, is this supposed to be a slave? Yes, it's historically accurate,